Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. Check out our website,
We've talked about Seinfeld. We've talked about Seinfeld.
themagufficom. Next up, we'll be talking about Seinfeld. I assume this will fall into a fourth part somehow. For the show about nothing, it seems to be the podcast about everything. We talked about Seinfeld as part three of hopefully a three-part podcast. But yeah, check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. Follow us on Twitter to find the other ones. Subscribe to us on iTunes. And yeah, all right, theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
Ah, Seinfeld Part 3.
Yes. I'm so glad we're getting 5 mil an episode for this.
Is that how much they were making by the end?
Jerry turned down 5 million per episode for season.
Oh, for season 10?
For season 10. So yeah, more than 100 million for a season.
Wow.
Yeah. People liked it.
It seemed to be a popular show. Judging by the fact that it seems to be like accidentally quoted every day of my life.
Yeah. So where do we leave off?
We ended up talking about Susan's death. The end of the invitations is where we left off.
Okay.
Yeah. So Susan's dead. Yeah. Put an end to that cliffhanger. She's not coming back except for about a minute in the betrayal. But yeah, Susan dies. And the first,
it sounds like we're being kind of flippant about it, but
I feel like
flippant than this entire television show.
Yeah, exactly. So. I think I read a quote, Larry David talking about how he saw the show again recently, the episode again recently, and his reaction was, "I can't believe I killed that girl," like laughing and saying that. And I thought that was a really funny thing.
Yeah, because she was such a sweet character for the most part too.
She never seemed to be actively malicious.
Yeah, which is a lot in the Seinfeld universe.
Yeah, exactly. Which is pretty much a good Samaritan as far as...
Right. As far as did you ever see the dedication for this episode?
No.
So there was a female writer named Marjorie Gross who died between the season premiere, between the season finale and the season premiere that we're dealing with right now.
Yeah.
And they dedicate this episode to her. And... as we said, it's a very flippant episode about a woman's death. Yeah. And it's just not kind of handled with a lot of delicacy or gravity. So yeah. I thought that was interesting. I didn't know if that's something that you'd see much anymore, but I think the people making Seinfeld were kind of a different crowd, it seems.
Yeah, it certainly seems that way.
Yeah. So yeah, Susan's death, as we kind of discussed, not really handled with a lot of seriousness. Yeah. Spock's death in Star Trek II is handled more delicately within Seinfeld than Seinfeld's Susan's death is, which I thought was very interesting.
Yeah, and with the Foundation, I mean, it really gets driven home. The reason I mentioned that we should talk about this episode is just because of when George goes to visit the grave and how... I don't know. It's like, I mean, it's an obligation for him, but like an obligation that he wants absolutely no part of, you know, like it's just he has to go and he'll talk to his dead fiance's grave. But it's like he's going to talk about baseball, you know, like it's and he's going to be totally unmoved by the whole thing. Like, I don't know. It's just I still can't wrap my head around it. It's so it's so weird. You know?
It does seem so cold. Like you would imagine that. NBC would have had some problem with it, but I think they were just, they'd been making so much money for them for so long that they could maybe deal with a bit of criticism about it for what a juggernaut the show was.
Yeah, exactly. It's like George could have been like printing money next to her grave while having that conversation. And I think it would be an adequate reflection of why NBC allowed that conversation to exist.
Yeah, we talked a bit in the last episodes of kind of how relationships are something to be escaped. And just very few relationships in the show are shown in a positive light. George's parents are constantly fighting. Jerry's parents are constantly fighting. But you then the Costanzas tend to.
Yeah.
But what's interesting, I think, about Susan's death and the nature of it is that it's a direct result of her engagement. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
It's the envelopes that kill her. It's licking all these envelopes. You know, they said we're expecting about 200 people. And that's what's so funny to me. It was the envelopes and it was inviting more people. It was having this big wedding, inviting more people to come and, you know, witness this the ceremony and, you know, what should be this very pleasant thing of two people expressing their love for each other. That's what does her in. And we kind of just get this equation of love and marriage and relationships with death, like that kind of being the end of you. And I think that's something that runs through the show, definitely. But it's driven home really well, I think, kind of that one plot point. And it is super funny, and it talks about how cheap George is and all these things. But it is kind of just this very bleak statement on, you know, adult romantic relationships.
Well, and then going with what you've been talking about, the way Susan's parents are shown throughout the rest of the show. And when they appear briefly. I think most prominently in the episode where George claims to have a house in the Hamptons. And they are just shown as broken people, like alcoholics who just sit around and drink all day. And that pretty much seems to be all they do anymore. And that's also kind of a comment on the fact that they're rich, like they're too rich to have to do anything. But I think the fact that it also works as a reaction to their dead daughter, you know, who they then eventually say that they blame George for her death, you know?
Yeah, it's very explicitly.
Yeah,
and they're always constantly making backhanded comments about each other and, you know, in kind of this upper, it's less kind of white trashy, you know, not just screaming at each other that we see the Costanzas do for the most part. But it's just as cold. It's just as mean.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of done in a more high class kind of way. But it's, again, it's just a clearly unhappy thing. It's this bad relationship. Mm-hmm. One of many, many, many that we see throughout the series.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's pretty much all I got on the foundation. I just felt like it's such a big moment in the series, and the way they handle it is so typically Seinfeldian, you know?
Yeah, and even also just kind of continuing to not let George have anything, you know, as dark as it is. He wants this marriage to end in any case, you know, in this death seems to be one that he is more than okay with because it means the ending of this relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But he continues to pay the price for ever wanting marriage, you know, for, as he says, I'm sick of being single, I'm getting out. And anything, this kind of giving up hope on single life and embracing, you know, romance and marriage, it follows him for years and years. I mean, he's now stuck in this foundation. He doesn't get any of the money that he would have received if he married Susan, which seems to be his only real moment of remorse about Susan's death is when he finds out the financial implications of it. You know, and now he's stuck, and he kind of pays this penance for trying to appreciate romance by having all his nights and weekends taken up for him to give away money that should have been his to people he's never met before.
Yeah.
It's pretty remarkable. I mean, it's odd because Susan's obviously the more sympathetic victim here, but in kind of the twisted Seinfeldian logic that this show has, it's George who kind of gets the worst end of all of this.
Yeah. Yeah.
and that's the beginning of season 8, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And so Jerry Seinfeld's now an executive producer on the show because Larry David has left, and this is kind of the first episode with no Larry David, right?
Yeah, that's my understanding at least.
Yeah. Do you think that there's a downturn in quality with Larry David leaving?
I think a little bit, but I also kind of think that it was happening a bit before Larry David left, you know? And when I say a quality downturn, I mean a quality downturn by Seinfeld standards, which is that the show was perfect for a long time. And then around season 6, sometimes there weren't things I was crazy about, you know? And I can't even, like, the other thing is I can't even think of specific examples, but it's just like, you get spoiled, you know, you get spoiled watching, you know, season two of Seinfeld is amazing. 3, 4, and 5 are pretty much like flawless, you know, and then it's, I remember it started to be around 6th where every once in a while there was something that I wasn't crazy about and it would just be a little thing. And then sometimes in 7th season, maybe it was a whole episode, but, yeah, I mean, there's definitely a downturn in quality as the show progresses. And I, other than Breaking Bad, and my argument is with Breaking Bad that every successive season is better than the one that came before it. And that is the only show that I've ever seen do that. Every show, all of my favorite shows end up having some sort of quality downturn just because they are lucky enough to run long enough to have a downturn in quality, you know?
Yeah.
So yes, there is a downturn in quality, but it's a slight one. And if we're getting like an 85%, if we're getting 85% as good as the Seinfeld episodes we used to get, then we should be so lucky, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So. Did you want to move on to the next episode?
Yeah. The Betrayal, I suppose. We could call this a gimmick episode if you want.
It is, and it's one... that you suggested we put on this list, mm-hmm. and you stated that you were very surprised that this is kind of one of the more negatively viewed episodes.
Yeah, I was just looking it up after I saw it, and I couldn't believe that people not even just seemed to be like on the fence about it, but like seemed to actively dislike it. And I've got to say, I found that very surprising. Like, what do you think about this episode?
I think it's great. I've always loved this
okay.
episode.
All right. So I'm not crazy. I'm glad to know I'm not insane.
You're not crazy, but yeah, you're right about what you said, that this is kind of one of the two episodes that are widely disliked, this and the Puerto Rican Day Parade, which we'll talk about.
It's just the Puerto Rican later. Day.
Pardon?
It's just the Puerto Rican Day, I believe is the title.
Oh.
Which is actually like one of my favorite jokes in that episode.
That is pretty funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the betrayal, okay, so this is after Larry David's gone, which I think a lot of people saw as a sign of, you know, him getting off a sinking ship.
Mm-hmm.
And this just kind of being, you know, the sound of the ship going underwater, I guess. I don't know. And the jump the shark phrase has been used on this. And I get I get why people could point to this one, and it's because of the gimmick.
Exactly.
It seems like we've run out of ideas and now we're doing this.
Mm-hmm.
I get that criticism, but I think it's just crafted so well that it's, I still love watching it so much that I can't call this a shark jump by any means.
Yeah, exactly.
It has some of the, like some of the ingredients of the recipe, you know, a gimmick. It's based on the Harold Pinter's play, The Betrayal, which mm-hmm. is the movie as well. And I think some people from Roseanne kind of famously got upset about how they, you know, they think they're doing high theater. It's just a sitcom. And it was just a time when the show was so successful and then tried something kind of gimmicky that it is easy to say that, you know, this is it. This is where we jump the shark. This is the clear sign that the show is not as great as it used to be and it never will be that great again.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand that. Like, it doesn't surprise me that people can point to this one.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to think after, you know, 7 and some years of being one of the biggest shows on television, being, you know, a cultural phenomenon, that it gets to a point where there's just a backlash when something's so big and so yeah. famous for so long that, you know, we reach that point, or, you know, as a society where we say, you know, we take something and we point to that as a clear sign that that's, this thing is over or the best days are behind it.
Yeah, exactly. And it's been like 8.5 years. This is a mid-season 9 episode.
Oh, yeah, true. Yeah. Yeah. I just think it's really funny.
Yeah. And I will say, in regards to the idea of the gimmick, I found it much less enjoyable the second time watching it, just because, you know, you kind of know the jokes. It's kind of, you know, it's just because it's so reliant on the gimmick that once you kind of know the gimmick, it's just way less fun to watch. But it is still a very funny episode. But like, when I watched it, I mean, and I assume this is exactly what they wanted me to think, but when I started the episode, I was like, oh, something is wrong. Something is wrong with my copy of this episode. Everything, yeah. Everything is, I shouldn't be starting this file with the Castle Rock logo. And, And that's exactly what they wanted me to think. And as I sort of let it play out for a minute, I was like, oh, maybe it's not. But it seems to be the end of the episode. And then by the 2-minute mark, I was like, oh, they're doing this, you know? And it was,
yeah.
And I loved that. I loved that a show that has every right to get comfortable. It has no reason to try harder than it, any harder than it needs to. I have such a strong respect for that and for being able to even attempt it, let alone succeed. And I think they succeeded because I find it a very, very funny episode. I think I've mentioned earlier in part one or part two that I don't care much for the Kramer plot line, but pretty much everything else is really interesting.
Yeah, other than Kramer's growing lollipop.
That is a joke I really enjoyed.
Yeah, I love that joke so much. Yeah, no, it's good. And I mean, played out for it, it seems like it has all the makings of a Seinfeld episode.
Yeah, it's a little bigger than even later season Seinfelds don't really get this big all that often, where it's like the gang goes to India, you know, like and goes to a wedding, you know. It's like two sitcom plots put together, you know. It's like the gang goes to a wedding, the gang goes to India, you know. But
and then plus Kramer's plot.
Yeah, exactly. But I just really enjoy this episode, and it's got some good Elaine, obviously, which I enjoy. It's got some Elaine ipso facto. It's got some good Elaine. I enjoy there's a lot of really good Elaine in season 9 as far as like playing with all those things I talked about in, I believe, the previous episode, where she's just like this faux progressive person that is actually just out for what's best for her. And her, like, you see it with her trying to force herself into George's wedding, to be an usher or whatever, like just any role in the wedding. She's like, no, I'm in the wedding, you know? And she hates Sue.
It doesn't like George that much anyway.
Yeah, exactly. They have what, like 6 or 7 one-on-one scenes throughout the course of the series, most of which are about how they never talk to each other one-on-one. But she hates Sue Ellen Mishke until she's asked to be her maid of honor / best friend. And it's just like, oh, that makes me seem better. You know, I'm into it. You know, like that makes me seem like you hold me on this higher ground, you know, so... So immediately I'm on board, despite the fact that I hate you, you know?
Yeah. So. Yeah. No, one thing you said, I meant to mention when you mentioned the, how they do the Castle Rock intro, like they just go 100% with this gimmick.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's, mm-hmm. they've got all the credit, mm-hmm. the music, it's all running perfectly backwards. And, I think it's great.
Yeah, and you've got some good post office jokes in this one, too, which is a thread you get in a lot of Seinfeld episodes with Newman, where he just makes jokes with the postal service. But I always get a kick out of them. I think they're so funny. It's such a like a 90s thread of joke, but it's like talking about lawyers or something. Like Jackie Chiles is such a 90s character, and obviously he's supposed to be Johnny Cochran. But I don't know, that type of stuff. I always get a kick out of it.
Yeah, no, still, it's good. And I'm glad you did like this one as much. Like even the sneeze and excuse me joke, it's so short and it's so useless, but it's so funny.
Yeah, and I also like, I will promise I will make this as quick as possible. I strongly believe that the creators of How I Met Your Mother saw this episode and were then like, okay, we're going to make How I Met Your Mother. Like this episode is 100% the genesis of How I Met Your Mother, because How I Met Your Mother is just, it's Seinfeld with time shifting and
just stretched into a decade.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, we don't need to get into the positives and negatives of that show, but I was just watching, after I watched that episode, I was like, well, that's when Carter Bays and Craig Thomas decided they had a show, you know. And they also played with language the same way Seinfeld did. The betrayal also has, I think, the most prominent usage of alcohol in the series, which obviously I paid a lot of attention to, because we haven't talked about this yet, but I find the way that alcohol is depicted throughout the show pretty interesting, in that it's not necessarily something to be feared, but it's definitely something to be kept a distance from, you know, especially yeah. in the opening few seasons. Like it's pretty much an occasional mention of Hennigan's, scotch, which nobody ever seems to want to drink, only drink when they really have to. And it's this one bottle in Jerry's apartment that keeps coming back from time to time. And it's probably till like season 7 or whatever when you see Jerry, I guess it's the invitations where he gets engaged and it's like pouring champagne. I think that's the first time we see Jerry hold alcohol that he has any intention of drinking. And
yeah,
I think that's pretty
interesting. He has a bottle of wine in the first episode.
Does he? Okay.
But reluctantly, it's because his guest asks for it.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, it's just that, like, alcohol is it's so bizarre because you get to sitcoms now and they're like very frequently built around alcohol, and Cheers before it was certainly built around alcohol. Like, you know, it's always sunny in Philadelphia, which I think is a direct descendant of Seinfeld. How I Met Your Mother, I mentioned. Happy Endings is another good one. Like, these are all shows that just are very much descendants of Seinfeld that exist at least 60% in bars, you know, and that the show that inspired so much seems to kind of fear alcohol is really interesting. And the only like negative thing that characters seem to say about alcohol is that Elaine's father was an alcoholic. But other than that, it doesn't seem like alcohol affects them very much. They just stay away from it, you know?
Yeah. And even in this one where it's, you know, seen as, you know, I guess
the key
a negative,
to the vault.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say a negative force just mm-hmm. in that it makes a certain character not be able to keep secrets that she would like to keep.
Mm-hmm. It's and then not, other characters would very much like her to keep as well.
Yes. Yeah. It's just not handled with a lot of weight, but I guess nothing on Seinfeld really is.
No, exactly. No, it's kind of interesting that it's the only episode where alcohol seems to come to the forefront. And Elaine gets drunk and makes out with somebody at a party later in the season. But and there's certainly fallout to that. But we don't see the actual action. I think this is the only time we see a drunk character on the show, of the main four, at least. Yeah.
And what an entertaining drunk she
oh,
is.
Gosh. It's so good. I love good drunk acting. I love Julia Louis-Dreyfus. Yeah.
Yeah, it's all over this episode.
When she's like physically climbing on Jerry, I find it so funny. Anyway, yeah. Right.
So
big
everyone
fan of
start
the
taking the betrayal.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I feel like now, I mean, that's the problem with Seinfeld is that it's just impossible to find a comparison point because nothing will ever be Seinfeld again as far as like cultural recognition. But like, I feel like now if there was some sort of show like this, I feel like the betrayal as an episode would be better received. Because I mean, this is airing in probably early 1998. And I think that's kind of a really big swing for that time, you know? And I don't know, it just seems like time shifting. I mean, you can point to Pulp Fiction. You know, Pulp Fiction was a movie that really kind of introduced time shifting to mass culture. And
just a few years before this episode.
Exactly. 94 is Pulp Fiction. And I mean, you see it start to come into play in a lot of movies in the years following. And, you know, culture just sort of started to become more accepting of time shifting. I feel like now if somebody was to do the exact same thing, then it would work better. I mean, again, How I Met Your Mother was built around time shifting and it was a huge hit, so I guess it works. Yeah,
or it would be the most normal episode of Community.
yeah exactly. Yeah, cultural sensation Community.
That's right.
Yeah, 100,000 viewers an episode or whatever.
Yeah. So speaking of viewership, I just kind of had a general question about Seinfeld. When I was looking over some of the ratings and some of the stats about the show, mm-hmm. and just that, you know, you see its ratings share, and you break that down, it means that 10% of Americans watching TV were watching Seinfeld at this point, which is a crazy high number, right?
Oh, yeah.
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 But when you hear those numbers from, you know, 2 decades ago or whatever it is, do you think that means more people are actively watching? Like, do you have more captive viewers now or then when you hear about stats like that? Because there's fewer things to be distracted, but there's also fewer things to just turn on and kind of have in the background and things like that.
Yeah,
as far as captive viewers per, you know, per 100 viewers. Where do you think that sits?
I think it's probably about the same. I think it's always, it just comes back to a more general question of how I would assume culture's focus in general gets a little weaker every year, you know, just because there are more things to draw from that focus. But I mean, you know, I'm sure people would do laundry during Seinfeld sometimes or something, you know, it's just, yeah, I think there's always some sort of distraction. It just, distractions existed before the iPhone, you know what I mean? So I don't know. I don't have an answer for that. I would assume that it's closer than you think, but still it would be more focused viewership in the 90s than now, you know?
Yeah, it's like right away I saw that and thought, you know, oh, well, people must be, you know, so much more distracted now. But when there's only one, like, I kind of did the same thing where I kind of had to walk it back a bit and figured, you know, it wasn't the 90s. Everyone was just giving everything their complete focus all the time, obviously. So yeah, I just didn't know where you felt about.
Yeah, we were really sitting down and like and thinking about those Backstreet Boys records as we played them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's the only reason Limp Bizkit got so far is with careful deliberation about their talent.
Yeah. I don't really have any more thoughts about it. I don't have.
Okay.
Yeah. It's an interesting. It is an interesting thought, though, that I think a lot of people wouldn't bring up. So.
Yeah.
So kudos to you, T-Bone. I just wrote the last thing I want to mention about the betrayal is the tag. Yeah. The tag at the end of the episode. I love it. The 2 years earlier, where we get sort of a lot of the.
Oh, and. Yeah,
Nina talking about the internet is the beginning of the tag. And then everybody comes in, Susan included. And when Susan walked in, I was like, "Aw, you guys, that's great. That's such a good idea." And then when she says you could stuff your stories in a sack, mister, so great.
That is huge payoff.
Because, yeah, they reference that line 3 times at the very beginning of the episode. And then it's such a good payoff. And then, yeah, you're right with the Kramer and Jerry meeting. Even aside from that Kessler joke, which we mentioned in an earlier podcast and I love. Even aside
just
from that,
what's mine is yours.
Yeah, and it's just such a great callback to, I don't know, I just like that we were able to see Jerry and Kramer meet, and it's kind of the only episode where that would make sense. I think there's, what, like one other there's one flash forward episode and one other flashback episode, which is the library. And I think that's pretty much it for time shifting in the show. Maybe a little bit here and there, but...
Yeah.
There aren't a lot of episodes where that scene would fit, and I think it's great that they were able to do that.
Yeah, and stuff your stories in a sack. It was always funny to me because it's such a not George phrase. Like, yeah. It's such a not our main four Seinfeld phrases at all. You knew that came from, like, a very particular person.
Yeah.
And it makes sense that it's Susan because that's such a more Susan thing. And, you know, so that's a bit of a callback. But I think the thing with Kramer, it's not even a callback. It's like this big explanation about so much of their relationship and his character. Like, it was just one little seed planted on one day. And, you know, I'm not saying that one thing is what turned Kramer into Kramer. Surely he'd overstep his boundaries. But it was just really funny to see Jerry kind of invite this frustration into his life that... you know, he ends up spending so much time and money on just making up for what Kramer has taken from him in one way or the other.
Yeah. Well, I guess this is a good time of question, or as good a time as time. What? Fuck it. Whatever. Who cares?
Time.
What is time? To ask, this is one of the main questions that was in my head throughout watching Seinfeld. Why are they friends with Kramer?
Convenience. I mean, he's right there. He provides him with opportunities to have some fun.
Yeah, exactly. He's got 600 Titleists, so that's why they're friends.
Yeah, no, he's so close. He is funny. I don't know. And I mean, it ties into a question I wanted to ask you about the finale, about if Kramer's really as bad as the rest of them. But we'll save that for the finale. What were you going to say?
No, it's just, I don't know. Like, I don't know. I think, like, a lot of the times when he's being funny in a way that, like hurts Jerry, George, or Elaine in some way. And I don't know. It's just weird. And I just tried to think of my, my most Kramerian friends, and like I could think of reasons why I'm friends with them, despite the fact that many of the things that they have done have, you know, hindered my own life. But it, like, I could also think of things that they actually brought to the table, you know?
Yeah. Well, okay. So Kramer, here's the best answers I can really come up with. Mm-hmm. Jerry likes feeling better than people.
Okay. Yep. That's a good answer.
There's a lot of things about Kramer that he feels superior to. Mm-hmm. He doesn't work or have a family, so he's always free. And mm-hmm. I think it's important to value friends who are always up for anything because they have nothing else going on. I'm not saying this is a good life choice, but I think that is a factor.
I understand the I have friends that I keep in my life only because I know they are available people.
Yeah.
I think I'm that person for like five different people.
And he... I think he, you know, as I kind of was hinting at my question, I think he is the nicest of the three of them. And he seems to be at times he has, he does have a negative effect on people around him, like, you know, taking Jerry's food and belongings and things like that. But there aren't a lot of times where he seems malicious or seems to put himself, okay, I can't really say he doesn't put himself in front of other people, yeah. But he seems good hearted. He seems to value friends and people more than other people do, as weird as that sounds.
Yep.
I can see George and Jerry and Elaine all taking something for themselves instead of giving it to their friends or having something bad happen to someone else in this group of four, whereas I think Kramer has a good heart, just he's a space cadet.
Okay.
And I think that's why he's kept around, along with being so close.
Okay.
And constantly available.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough.
And funny in the way that, you know, that people find Kramer funny all the time.
Yeah. Yeah,
as a hipster doofus.
Yeah.
And he's full of good stories.
Yeah.
And good fans like Bob Sacamano.
Don't forget Lomaz. And sometimes he brings home stale bagels, which leads into our next episode. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Oh, they did.
Yeah, all right. Let's get to that.
Yeah. The strike. Perhaps more popularly known
very
as
Kramer heavy episode. Yeah. Lots of...
Perhaps more famously known as the Festivus episode.
Yeah. Oh man, I don't even know where to start. I mean Kruger might be my number one Seinfeld boss mm-hmm. of all time. Get us good Kruger.
Yeah, no, there's plenty of good Kruger in this. I have a deep appreciation for Jerry Stiller, and there is some great Jerry Stiller in this episode. Like when he's talking about the story that leads to Festivus, he's talking about like how they're both going for this doll, and he's just like, "As I rained blows down upon him," like that line is so funny because it's delivered just like, "Of course I was punching this man," like it's so insane. It's so wonderful. Well, and just as a performer, he's just so, so funny to me.
Yeah, well, in that line itself, as you said, like, it's delivered as such an inevitability to the story. Like, of course I start wailing on the guy. Like, that goes without saying. But just the poetry of, as I rain blows upon him. And as we talked about in the marine biologist episode, there is some very crafty poetic wordplay in these episodes. Like when they want to kind of go for it, it's done so well when they get, you know, they're not getting high minded about it. They're not getting pretentious about it, but they're just kind of, you know, propping up these characters and their dreams and goals and ambitions and histories and just a very, very pleasing litter. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and the Costanzas in general are fantastic.
Yeah, no, they're great. Love Mr. Love Mrs. And another one of my favorite Jerry Stiller moments is when he's talking about how people have disappointed him in the past year. I've got a lot of things to say about you people or whatever. And he starts talking and then he's just like, just stops. I lost my train of thought and sits down. It's so funny.
Well, and it explains so much about George too, and why he's so twisted and depressed and Just kind of like that moment of Jerry saying Kramer can have anything in his apartment. It's just kind of one of these moments where you can look backwards at everything and say, oh, okay, this, I'm kind of seeing the genesis of this now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. So you picked this episode. Why did you want to talk about it?
Just that it's a classic. Like, it's so big. The Festivus, it's one of those ones that I think is kind of the two-hander, and that the Festivus plot line is the one that is so good and people still quote and remember. And I think the H&H Bagel plot line would have been just fine on its own. Like, mm-hmm. I think that's a great little bit. That's the area code one too, right? Yeah.
No, I think that one is later. That's the maid, yeah, I think.
Yeah, Elaine giving out her phone number is what threw me off, which I think is funny as well.
The exactly. And you get to talk about Whatley if you want. You can drop some B-Cran love here if you need.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of it is the cast. Like, first of all, I if you hadn't mentioned it, I would say that this is just Jerry Stiller at his finest in this series. And there's tons of good Jerry Stiller, but this is just next level. I love Kruger. Why not George? That's just drinking at the family table.
Yeah,
I think that's really funny.
Well, and that actor's just really talented too. I think he was the army captain in Malcolm in the Middle and was always really funny in that. But anyway, so yeah.
No, Kruger's he just kind of has. He is kind of the similar thing as Putty, where he's kind of very aloof and very intense at the same time, and mm-hmm. I think that's really, really rewarding for me. Just very, very funny. Yeah. And yeah, great Festivus, obviously huge, still being felt to this day.
Yeah.
Feats of Strength is good. I like a lot of the off-screen jokes in it too as they wrestle. And yeah, what you said about Jerry Stiller I think is just bang on. So that was kind of my Festivus love.
Yeah. Cool. I'm into it. Love Festivus. Love Jerry Stiller.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bookstore next?
Yeah. Yeah, that's what's next in our list.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fan?
Yeah. No, it's good. I'm curious to know why you put this one on the list as well, actually.
Okay.
Because I will say, like, okay. The main thing when I saw your list was that it was very late season heavy, especially 9. I think we talked about like 5 or 6 episodes in season 9, which I was surprised about. But
I was the oldest for season 9. It's mm-hmm. the season that, I mean, for obvious reasons, you can look at now and it doesn't look a ton different visually than what you would imagine a multicam or single cam sitcom to look like now.
Yeah, this is a multicam sitcom.
Yeah. Like, I think it, and I mean, just as we've talked about with so many things, it was when I was at the right age for these to be kind of, you know, formulating my opinions on things. Mm-hmm. And I can remember seeing some of these episodes new and like watching them for the first time. And I know we've kind of talked about how it's a quality kind of downturn by this point, at least. I think in a lot of ways they kind of found their footing and they knew what they were. And I think that's why one of the reasons why it does end after season 9 is they've kind of figured it all out. And it seems like all these episodes to me seem really rounded. They're a lot bigger. As much as I love Jerry Steinfeld's stand up, it wasn't the right place to have it kind of sprinkled in throughout the episodes.
Yep.
And they just had bigger plots because they had more time to do things with. A lot of them get a bit ridiculous, but I'm so okay with that. There's just some bigger, kind of goofier, louder moments in season 9 that I think work a lot. As far as the bookstore, we've got Uncle Leo, who we've yet to mention, I think.
Yeah.
Who definitely needs mentioning.
Which side of what side of the family is he on? Whose brother is he? Is he Morty or Mrs. Seinfeld?
It's never really clarified.
Okay.
Family relationships in this show are not really fleshed out that well. There's mentions of brothers and sisters who you only hear about once.
Yeah.
It's all very weird. And Uncle Leo, I don't think he has a side of the family. I think he's just everyone's that uncle. You know?
Yeah, okay.
There's no explaining it away.
That's fair.
I very much like the swarming in this episode.
Yeah, oh, that's so funny.
Yeah, like that's a winner.
Like the idea that this bookstore has like five security guards working at it.
Exactly. Even like, of course they wouldn't, and they wouldn't like, behave this way.
The idea that that bookstore has five employees working at it is funny. You know, like it seems like such a small bookstore. But.
Yeah, and it's also I think it's a good George episode because I think he's wrapped up in one of his big, you know, me against the world kind of things. He goes to a bunch of different stores. He has this opinion about books and hygiene that doesn't line up with anybody else's, even Jerry and Elaine and Kramer, who often will agree with him in some of his weirder beliefs. Mm-hmm. None of them are on the same page as him. So it's a good kind of George against the world episode.
Yeah.
Funny one too. And I think it's, George has all these scatological, societal, weird things. And this explores it really deeply. And I think that's very funny.
Yeah. Okay. I can see that.
Yeah. There's nothing really profound about it. It's just another season 9 one that I think is really strong. And I think they know what they're doing. And you know, it's, we do end shortly after this. And when I say they've kind of figured things out, I mean it in a good way and a bad way. I think they've kind of, as Jerry seems to have felt, have explored so many things and they're still having fun. They've still got a really good grasp on the characters. They still have all these relationships they can call back to. And, you know, the Uncle Leo thing, he's a character we know so much about. And, you know, the not saying hello thing comes back into play after a few seasons. And I think that's a really good one. It's just that the universe is built up enough that you can do those kinds of jokes, you know, from 3 years earlier and still have them land. Like, you know, Jerry has to go talk to him. He wants to say hello or he's going to hear again, but then something happens. And it's just kind of a very fleshed out universe for them to play in. And I think that's part of what I like a lot about season 9 episodes.
Yeah, that's fair. And I mean, I think this a very good example of this episode where they're allowed to do bigger things that are kind of fun is really in the opening where Jerry leaves the apartment with Kramer in it, and Kramer just has a little night to himself in Jerry's apartment, you know, and that's very that's very late Seinfeld, you know? Like they're not doing that in season 3.
No, and it's exactly, it's having built up to this and seeing what he could do. And again, Kramer taking all these liberties and Jerry coming back and having missed out on so many things that would freak him out, but still finding a cup off a coaster to be, to, you know, to get hung up on
and for sure.
Say, I can't believe this, which is the most believable thing ever. Not using a coaster.
Like, it's pretty much anybody not using a coaster.
Exactly.
Such an easy thing to forget to do.
And coaster use is very lax on that table throughout the entire series. So, it's kind of remarkable to me. But yeah, I think that intro is a very unusual one that I think is a very funny one.
Yeah. Yeah,
and seeing him pretending to host a TV show again is wonderful.
Yeah, two times in one season. And this is also the episode, we talked a lot about it in a previous episode, where Elaine has to help her not really a boyfriend get over a heroin addiction, and how flippantly that whole thing is discussed. And I had forgotten about the heroin thing, and that I think that alone makes this episode worthwhile, and because some good Elaine, like not caring at all about this guy despite helping him get over an addiction. And this is probably a couple episodes after she dates a guy that might be poor or might be married, and she seems to think being poor is more problematic. It's a couple episodes after the one where she dates a black guy, or maybe doesn't, which is an episode I love, but revolves around the idea of Elaine thinking she's a good person, but nobody can tell. Like, and she's probably not, you know. And the bookstore just really drives it home, you know. Like, she's doing something a good person would do, but she's not doing it the way a good person does it.
The episode where she's dating the possibly black guy and realizing they're both white people and just saying, do you want to go to the Gap?
Yeah.
I think sums up so much of Elaine's
well, yeah.
Liberal maybe caring. Like, she's smart enough, but isn't that that concerned?
Yeah, exactly. Like, and George asks her at one point, why don't in that episode, why don't you just ask him? And she says, I can't ask him because then it will seem like I care about it. And like, just by
when she's just spent the whole episode caring about.
Yeah, exactly. And then George is immediately like, I don't think we should be talking about this. And he does that a couple times throughout the episode. And I mean, that episode is The Wizard, and that's one of my favorite episodes in the whole series, just because of the way it deals with race. I found it fascinating and incredibly frank, and really just all around interesting. But yeah, as far as the Elaine stuff goes, it's really ties in with her thread throughout the season, in that she will date anybody as long as it seems to elevate her in some way. Yeah.
And another thing about this episode and season 9 in general, I do love Krueger, but you gotta give it up for Peterman as well.
Oh, I mean, Peterman's great.
Oh, he's so, so good. And I was just watching this one and him talking about heroin, and he's just such a talented performer, and it's so funny. Just every second he's on screen, he just owns it. Yeah. So yeah, that's part of my season.
Yep, for sure. He's great. The maid?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think we referenced this line earlier, but I love the suicide talk or the nickname talk. It's like one is so like so heavy and so dark, and the other one is so cute and playful. Yeah. And I think that's the entire series in one line is just that, and dealing with these two kind of polar opposite things thematically, mm-hmm. and just rolling them up into one. And Cherry showing no concern over if it is the suicide,
yeah, exactly.
but would like to clarify which one it is just for moving forward with this conversation.
Yeah, that's true.
Some good 90s love that this plot matters so much, revolves so much around phone numbers and how meaningful they are. Yeah. And just that no one even dials phone numbers anymore. So it's such kind of an irrelevant plot point now, but it's so huge. And I mean, the show is built on blowing things out of proportion and making things that don't matter seem like huge deals. But I think that's a good example.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. And Elaine being Gammy, obviously. Pretty great.
Yeah, that's pretty fantastic. And I mean, yeah, another episode where we just have such soft feelings about death here. Like, mm-hmm. it's she fakes the death, which must just be so traumatizing for this child, as we hear. And her whole thing with the phone guy, I couldn't place what episode it was, and I was so happy that we kind of just stumbled upon it.
Yeah.
Because she, you know, just contemplates murdering someone for no reason other than she might get away with it.
Yeah.
To which he responds with a pretty similar idea. And it's something about that line, that conversation is so good, again, because the death being handled in that way. But saying, I work for the phone company, yeah. so I've dealt with a lot of semantics. So don't lure me into some kind of maze of circular logic. That this is just such a common occurrence to him is fantastic to me. And yeah, just the comeback of I could have murdered you too is like, it's so heavy and so dark and just kind of just, like so many other things, just played for the laughs instead of the gravitas that it could garner.
Yeah. And that guy's in The Rock, so he gets bonus points.
He's in The Rock. The Krug approves.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Anything else in The Maid?
Not really. It's not one of my favorite episodes.
Any particular reason? Or?
No, it's not. I think it's just sort of general Seinfeld fatigue, maybe. Okay. In that, I mean, they've already done pimp jokes, you know, like, and that's sort of, you know, what you've talked about, and that they really kind of have done it all, you know, and you can see why it ends, mm-hmm. and all of that stuff. And it's still entertaining. And I love the, there's some good Kramer shouting in this episode when he's in other rooms and yelling, is that T-Bone? Why no T-Bone? and then after he comes out of the bathroom and then eventually leaves and yells out, he's sleeping with his maid. Like his yelling there is so funny to me. But yeah, it's just, it's not a standout episode to me by any means.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I and like, the maid actually has a really good episode when she's talking or line when she's talking about Coco. She's like, we have somebody who works down the maid service named Coco. Yeah. Coco. She's all right. Like, just out of nowhere. It's so weird. And that's honestly one of my favorite things in the episode. Just because it's so misplaced and so bizarre. And works so well. Yeah.
Yeah. And one-liners for this episode. Well, there's nothing classier than diddling the maid and chewing some I like Elaine up on her high horse and Jared having to defend it because they have kind of that the special relationship that Jerry and Elaine share.
Yeah. Oh, it's so good.
Her talking about Jerry's taste in women and how he handles them and things like that. And even just Jerry looking around after she leaves the first time without cleaning anything after taking a nap. I think that's pretty good too.
Yeah. The girlfriend took the nap. The maid made the bed.
That's right. Yeah. Do I know her from something too?
I don't think so. Or at least I don't. I guess I can't speak for you. Even though I so frequently do.
I'll allow it. Yeah. I'll continue to allow it.
Yeah. Although, like, playing with Seinfeld rules, you probably know her from something else. She was probably just on another sitcom in the 90s because of the way actors tend to bounce around from guest spot within the same network, typically.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about the amount of people that are on the show and the supposed Seinfeld curse for the main stars of the show?
I don't know how much I have to say. I mean, anybody that watches Seinfeld, it's just like that person's on the Seinfeld, that person's on Seinfeld, that person's on Seinfeld. But yeah, I don't really have much to say other than that. You know, they seem to be smart enough to keep the talented people around when they could, like Putty, they bring back, and Whatley, they've got a lot of, you know, I suppose I don't have much in the way of thoughts.
Okay. Yeah, no, it's just always, I mean, I thought I knew everything, and then I just see someone else.
Yeah, Constance Zimmer is there as waitress number two. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I the Seinfeld curse I get. I think it's telling that Elaine is Julie Louis-Dreyfus is the one that has had the most successful career as an actor. I mean, Jerry hasn't really tried to do all that much.
He has $9 billion.
Exactly. And I mean, I think he always just acted because it was kind of a necessity more than anything.
When you say it's telling that Julie Louis-Dreyfus is the most successful, what do you mean? You think that she's
it's not even that like she's necessarily more talented than anybody else. It's just that I mentioned that I feel like Elaine is the person that always comes off out of the main four. She's the person that comes off most like a person as opposed to a character. Like George is so George, and Kramer obviously is in his own universe. But whenever George has a moment of humanity, he has a moment of Costanza screaming about two scenes later, you know? Yeah. And Elaine, partially this is because of Julie Louis-Dreyfus' talent in somehow making Elaine seem like not just a terrible person who occasionally talks about murdering the phone guy, you know? I think it's just that Elaine was always painted as the most normal person on the show. And that Julie Louis-Dreyfus's performance elevated that normalcy despite the actual material she was reading, I think was what allowed her to sort of separate herself from Elaine.
Yeah. And as someone who has seen episodes of the Michael Richards show and Bob Patterson and, you know, most of the projects that these people went on to do, the New Adventures of Old Christine is better, let alone Veep, which is just straight up a very, very good show.
Oh, Veep is so good.
Yeah. So it's also and maybe part of that is because of her, but she's also the one who, you know, hitched her star to the right wagon, if you will.
Yeah, exactly. Veep very much like if Julia Louis-Dreyfus is replaced, it would be a lesser show, but it could still be mm-hmm. a very, very good show without her. I don't think anything's worse off for having Julie Louis-Dreyfus in it. I feel like that's probably a truth throughout her career. But
not even the Elijah Wood vehicle, North?
Stop acting like I saw North. Also, everybody is in that movie. So, I mean, you can't pin that on JLD.
Okay.
Did you ever see that movie? I feel like you saw that movie, right?
I saw that movie so many times.
Yeah. Well,
yeah, she and George are married. Elijah Wood's parents.
Oh, really?
Fun fact.
That's funny.
Wasn't that fun? What do you want to do? Do you want to do the finale and a bunch of questions I have, or do you want to call it one?
Let's just keep it going.
Okay.
More fun behind the scenes.
Whoa, that's staying in the edit?
Yeah. Oh, boy. Well, it's staying in the edit because we're keeping this episode going. And I don't want to have to go through and find the middle of the episode.
Okay.
I'm so, very lazy.
Puerto Rican Day Parade.
Puerto Rican Day.
Puerto Rican Day. The parade, as it's famously known.
Yeah. What you got?
Oh, well, this is another of the, you know, it's in that small category of the betrayal of two episodes that are widely held as among the worst. Mm-hmm. What do you think quality wise?
I think it's still fine. Like, I don't know. I'm not crazy about the episode, but I certainly didn't dislike it. It's still funny to me. It's got Blimp, the Hindenburg story, or whatever that title is.
Yes.
And I don't know. I like the whole Maroon Sob stuff. I think that's funny.
Why do you think it got the bad rap then?
I mean, they burn a flag. That's understandable, I think. It's generally a faux pas. And I think it's kind of... it's very on the fence with the way it treats... I think that's putting it mildly, the way it treats Puerto Rican culture in general. And it's very, like, if you have to point to an episode of New York liberal people being above the rest of us, you can point to this one really easily and be like, well, I mean, this is just total blindness for other people, you know? So, yes, I understand. I think even with its misgivings, it's still a pretty funny episode. You know, they had some misses, you know, like there's some tone deafness that exists in the episode, but other than that, it's fine.
Yeah. And I mean, we should say that, yes, they do burn the Puerto Rican flag and cause somewhat of a controversy because, as you said, that's a pretty universally known no-no to do something that. And the actual burning of the flag is not in a subsequent airings of the show, but, yes, was kind of a big deal at the time.
Yeah.
One of the many appearances of Art Vandelay.
Yeah. I like all that stuff. Of. The three of them in that house or in that apartment.
Yeah, all the aliases are great. Like the names and the performances, mm-hmm. I think, are all quite fantastic.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite name?
No.
H.G. Pennypacker, Art Vandelay, and Cal Varnson.
I like Pennypacker. That's a good one. It's just fun to say, right? But yeah, and you don't see Jerry pretending to be other people very frequently, so I kind of enjoy that. You know, it's par for the course for George and Kramer, but I like that Jerry's getting in on the act.
Yeah, it's, I mean, for so much of this show, it's Jerry above everyone else, and Jerry being the calm, cool, collected one who has his career in order and, you know, doesn't have to worry about... I mean, Elaine so often falls into the traps of her boyfriends or bosses, mm-hmm. And Jerry doesn't. You know, other than Schmoopy, I guess, it's very, very rare that Jerry kind of acts in a certain way because of a relationship, you know, business or social or romantic. Mm-hmm. And now, he's the one backed into the corner and... Jerry Seinfeld within the show actually having to act, so that's a rare feat. It's just him out of his comfort zone, and I love all the pseudonym stuff, like when anybody has to do it, so just having all three of them share the same space I think is pretty good. And the phrase Maroon Sob, I think is super funny to me for reasons I can't quite figure out.
For sure. And I also, I mean, I can't remember if I mentioned this in another part that we did, but I just love, there's just something about how frequently bathrooms are incredibly important to the characters, that I really like it. And I, I don't know why. I just think it's a funny thing, a funny note that they hit so frequently. That's so like specifically Seinfeld, you know, like it's not like that is part of the show that influenced anything else. You know, like there's no show built around an obsession with having to go to the bathroom or something. And I told you I didn't do a ton of research other than watching the show. At one of the things I actively tried to find out was how many times George uses the bathroom over the course of the show. And I couldn't find an answer, but it's like 2 to 3 times an episode, which okay, is so
that
amazing.
Like a lot, but
well, I think he probably uses the bathroom in every episode. I think on average, because there are episodes where he walks into Jerry's, goes to the bathroom, and then later they're in the diner and he's coming back from the bathroom or something like that.
Yeah. I know. And there is somewhere it's like 6 an episode. So that would bring the average up to somewhere more reasonable to what you're saying.
Yeah.
No, I just think it goes so perfectly about a show about nothing because it's the most basic, like other than eating, which is prominently featured as well. It's just the most basic, mundane, sometimes unpleasant, unremarkable thing about human existence. And that's what the show is. I mean, so often it's about the social aspects of that and having to do this, having to see your parents, having to, you know, just take any episode and figure out what weird social law is being kind of handled in that episode. But that physiologically, you know, like something you just have to do. And sometimes you have to deal with you know, the location or company or whatever it is, or in India, you know, the entire country. It's just such a fundamental basic human need. And Seinfeld, the show, just explores so much of that stuff and the social aspect. And this is just a biological one. And I think thematically makes total sense, right? And
yeah, absolutely.
George, of all people, having to be the one, obviously.
Yeah. Somebody that sees so much refuse in his own life, constantly trying to dispose of it.
I used to work at a Brentano's.
I love that character is named Rebecca De Mornay. I love it so much.
Why?
Because that's the name of an actress. That's the female lead in Risky Business is played by Rebecca De Mornay. It's just so funny that they used her name.
I knew that. I just didn't know if there was always a connection or something I was missing.
But. No, there's no, they never try and tie it together, but they know. They have to know. There's no way they don't. And it's just funny to me. I don't know why. And she's in 2 episodes. I think she's in the Muffin Tops episode too. But yeah, it's just funny. I don't know. It's a good name.
Top of the muffin to you.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll skip past the clip show and go to the finale.
Yeah, I think that came
because we are modern people.
You don't want to talk about how important.
Yeah. Well, there are 2 clip shows in Seinfeld's history, right?
And we love Green Day's Time of Your Life.
Does that get used in the clip show?
Leading up to the finale or something, there's a big one of the kind of montage and them hugging after rap on the last episode, I think. I don't even remember what.
Yeah.
It was the perfect time to use that song.
Yeah, exactly.
Was, yeah.
When that song was out and when Seinfeld rapping.
Yeah, it all timed out pretty nicely, except I love that show and I hate that song. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't even watch the clip shows.
Okay.
Yeah. I started them as like, oh, clip show. Skipping. Yeah.
Well, you're a bandwagon Seinfeld fan.
Yeah, so. Definitely. Absolutely. Jumped on the bandwagon in 2015.
Just when it was going full speed.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, finale then.
Finale.
Ooh boy.
Yeah. Return of Larry.
Yeah, Larry D's back. LD as they call him.
In the biz. So I assume Jerry asked him to come back for the episode, right? That's probably how that worked.
I would think so, but I imagine he'd want, actually, no, that guy's hard to predict. I was going to say, you imagine he would want something because this was so much of his baby and he was around for 7 years and, you know, co-creator. And, you know, as we talked in the last 2 episodes, a very important voice. And if you've seen Curb and stuff, you can see, or you can you know, do a pretty good job of surmising what it is Larry David brought to the table. And he and Jerry aren't the same people, but they kind of had this comedic sensibility that lined up in certain places. But you can see the ways that I think Larry David would be nudging the show. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've read interviews and things like that that back up a lot of those suspicions. Yeah, I mean, he's back for this. Finales are impossible, in my opinion. How do you feel about it?
I really like the first half. I think the first half is just like really funny.
Like until the trial, pretty
yeah,
much?
Yeah, exactly. And I anticipated liking it just because my understanding of the episode is that it was not well liked. So I assumed that I would like it quite a bit because people are idiots. People are the worst. yeah, I thought the trial was like a little too much for me.
Like a little too much kind of trotting out the memories kind of thing?
Kind of, and also a little too on the nose.
In what way?
Just that you've been rooting for these horrible people for 9 years. These people are horrible, and we are going to list off the reasons as to why they're horrible and how we made you still care about them, or at least tune in every week, you know? There's just something that feels off about it, and maybe I'm doing a poor job of explaining it because I suppose I haven't been able to explain it to myself, but I don't know, it seems like a combination of old-fashioned Seinfeld, where it's, the first scene is Jerry and George sitting in a diner having a conversation and being denied ketchup and all these like little very like early season Seinfeld sort of things, and then it kind of melds it with the bigger, bolder later season Seinfeld by doing the trial, and something about it just doesn't work for me, you know, as a whole. There's lots that I love about it, and I love the last scene. I mentioned the line where Jerry saying rationing his milk is one of the hardest things he's ever had to do. I think that line is beautiful and wonderful. I love it. But yeah, it's just something about it. It doesn't come together for me. Like obvious highlights throughout, but okay. As a whole, not crazy about it. Yeah.
Are you surprised by the largely negative response to it?
No, because, it's like you said, finales are impossible. Finales for the biggest show ever are impossible, you know, or one of the biggest shows ever are impossible. So,
yeah.
No, I mean, it could only ever let people down, you know. It never had a chance to blow anybody away.
Yeah, I always remember the reaction being worse than what I would expect, just in that people don't like finales anyway. But this one I thought was kind of visceral about how much people disliked it.
Well, my grade six teacher mentioned it in class, how much she disliked it the next day. Like that's the only time I've actually there. I remember the Friends finale being mentioned by a teacher the next morning too. But those are the only two television finales I can remember being mentioned in my classroom days.
Yeah. I mean, and you mentioned the ending, you know, I don't think I'm pointing anything out new, but we end very much where we begin, and it's Jerry and George talking about where the button is placed on a shirt. It's the first conversation that happens in the series, and it's the last conversation that happens in the series. And, you know, he even points out, I think we've had this conversation again. And it's just that, I don't know, to me, it's just the pessimism of Seinfeld and just the, we've gone through all these things and we've had all these bad experiences and things are the exact same. Like we didn't grow, we didn't get any further. We're not, you know, clear of the minutia and just discussing this trivia anymore. Mm-hmm. It's just exactly that.
Yeah.
I love the idea on paper. I think I can't hate this episode that much.
Oh, I certainly don't hate it at all. No.
Yeah, and I do, as I said, I do really love the idea on paper because this show is so much about rejecting social norms, rejecting romantic love, kind of painting even familial relationships kind of in a negative light, and just all these kind of anti-social quirks, you know, people are the worst. Just these very misanthropic kind of ideas about society and the reckoning, you know, this is, that's absolutely what this episode is. It's just a reckoning. It's these people. And I think I know what you mean by it's too on the nose. You know, they're literally being judged. Like there's a judge named Judge Arthur Vandelay, is, you know, looking over this parade of experiences that they've had over the past 9 years and determining that they are bad people and they're not fit for society. You know, this Good Samaritan law comes up and they just kind of fail the moral judgment of America.
Yeah.
And the, you know, the Honorable Mr. Vandelay says, your criminal indifference has rocked the very foundation our society is built upon. And, you know, something like, I can think of no better way than you to be isolated from it for a while. I just love that on paper so much. I love that they kind of embraced it. I rewatched it for this, but I don't know if I'll ever really sit down and want to watch the finale of this show ever again. Mm-hmm. It's not a ton of fun, but I think for a show that just leans so hard on this idea that people are bad, people dealing with other people only make them worse, your life sucks the more people you let close to you, and to have all these really, as I said, antisocial, misanthropic ideas being pushed forward in a very comedic way night after night, I think it only made sense that they had this reckoning and they had to kind of put the spotlight on just how bad these people are. And as you said, you either like them or you like watching them enough to tune in every week. And there was just this moment of having to point out that what they've been doing while creating one of the most successful TV shows of all time is so out of sync with what we have all agreed are the values we want to live by, the civilization.
Yeah. Yeah, and on that note, I will tell you the thing I love about this episode is the video that is shot and played again in court, where we see, you know, the guy get robbed and you can or get carjacked, and you can hear Jerry and Elaine and George's comments about it. And, you know, when we see it happen for the first time, it's just another scene from Seinfeld. And then when you see it replayed in court, it's so fascinating because it's we're seeing it in this sort of different reality. Like the first time we see it just like we see everything else contained within this show. Whereas the second time we see it, we're seeing it like it would be it's a much more realistic depiction of that sequence of events if it were to happen in real life. Like the jokes sound meaner. And just because like it feels like you're closer to the action just because the handheld camera, the fact that we by the end of the 90s are at least well versed enough in you know, reality television, just because of Cops, to know that, to sort of have the feeling of we're closer to the action because of the way this is shot. And it really kind of drives home the fact that these are terrible people, but we're just seeing them in a different reality, and it allows you to enjoy watching their adventures. And I think the problem with the episode is mostly tied into the fact that that one video, I think, gets across everything that the episode is trying to get across. And it takes 30 seconds, but the courtroom stuff takes about 20 minutes in the episode, you know? And I think that's the main problem, is that it's a great idea that is actually executed brilliantly in that one small sequence, but it's just relied on too heavily, you know? And another thing I even like about that video is when they're playing it back in court, they cut to George laughing at his jokes and like at his own jokes. And I love that too. I don't know. I think that portion of the episode is so smart and so on the nose, and but also in a way that's not over the top, like the trotting out of the Murderer's Row of guest stars is, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think it's so interesting that we're watching them watch themselves on TV.
Yeah.
Like it's we've been doing this for so long, and now take a step back and watch. Someone watching TV on TV and see the distance that gives you from something. And you know, as you said, when you see it the second time and it doesn't seem like a bit on Seinfeld, it seems like a bit on a court show or a bit on Cops or a bit on reality TV or a bit on any other television programming that is just so cold and, as I said, so out of sync with what we say we really want people to do in society.
Yeah. And the other thing I love about this episode is Jerry's last stand-up routine. Oh my god, it's so funny. So funny. And I, like, I had no idea about that bit. Like, I didn't, what he just says, so what is the deal with the yard? Oh my god, that's so funny.
Yeah, and we just get Jerry, you know, as he is, as someone who just kind of goes to the world, isn't remarkably changed by his location or his experiences or anything around him. You know, we see him, like, with the joke, like, anyone here from Sublock D? I'll talk slower. That's such, like, just an early 90s stand-up bit where you take out Cell Block D and put in a town or a neighborhood or a province or whatever. It's just Jerry being Jerry in, like, such a heavy situation and literally being threatened with murder at a point.
Yeah.
Just being very unfazed by it.
Yeah, no, I think that's the, as far as putting a button on this episode, I think that is just the perfect way to do it. Like, that they show him in his new environment, I think, is so important to driving the points home. And I think it's a really great minute of television.
Yeah, and it's great. And it's also, I think it does a great job of driving home the point. Like, if this episode is the reckoning and the judgment and society saying that what you've been doing is unacceptable and we all really dislike it and we won't tolerate it anymore, and Jerry shrugging his shoulders and saying, well, you know, that's who, like, I don't care. Like, I hear what you're saying and it means nothing to me, and I'm going to continue doing exactly what I've been doing and being exactly who I am now in what should be a terrifying environment, but I'm Jerry, so it's not.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. This bit of trivia came up in my research. Kramer very rarely says yes. He always says yup or yeah or giddy up or done or deal. I enjoy that so much too. And just kind of as someone who is unfazed by everything and kind of doesn't adhere to most people's standards, just in a different way than most of the characters do. And I bring that up as a segue that I kind of mentioned earlier. Do you think Kramer's as bad as everyone else?
I think, I don't know. I think he is, but a lot of times just through ignorance and...
Whoa, ignorant?
I stumbled over my words, man.
Okay.
Ignorance and stupidity, which I don't think are excuses, but...
They are a bit different. I get that.
Yeah. So I certainly do not think Kramer is a good person.
Okay.
I think he's better than the other three as far as, like, on the... like, what we think humans are...
Just saying so very little.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, exactly. It's not by much, you know?
Yeah. So, legacy.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking about it in 2015 for 3.5 hours.
Have you heard of this Seinfeld is unfunny effect?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
I don't even understand that sentence. Seinfeld is unfunny is just so, I don't know.
Well, let me break it down for you. It's this idea that people watching Seinfeld now or recently can watch, you know, an episode or two and not really understand why Seinfeld kind of occupies this space in pop culture that it does. Mm-hmm. And part of it is that it's so, like, the idea is that it's so influential and so many of the things that it did that were groundbreaking have been normalized and repeated and... you know, really fully adapted by pop culture, that to watch, well, it's really kind of just this really unremarkable plotless kind of comedy. Does that ring true for you at all? Like, did you find it hard to appreciate how new and different it was because of the massive influence it's had on like the shows you mentioned earlier, like It's Always Sunny and How I Met Your Mother?
Yeah, I guess it's kind of maybe I'm not the best audience for that question, because of course I think, and I don't mean this to be like, oh, I'm smarter than everybody else. I just mean I think more about pop culture than most people. You know, most people are smarter than me specifically because they think about pop culture less than I do. But I just think I can't not see those things just because they're so prominent to me. I think in a vacuum, this show's incredibly funny. Like,
yeah,
it's just and yeah, exactly. I mean, I know I'm preaching to a very sizable choir, but. I just can't even imagine somebody watching The Marine Biologist and not finding it hysterically funny. Like, that just, that's baffling to me.
Yeah, and I think the idea is that seeing Elaine dance that way, like, there's some things that don't go away with time, but there are some things that, for it being such a huge show, it just kind of muddies it by being so influential. And I mean, you could apply it to music, you could apply it to all these other things of something that was so good and so important that everyone after them want to be so much like them that when you watch them jumbled up, one of them doesn't really look remarkable anymore, but you have to appreciate it for what it was at the time.
Yeah, it's like we say on this podcast from time to time, you or I do, and it's a movie that say we don't really like as much as its reputation, where we say it's more interesting to think about than to watch, specifically because of the cultural impact it had, and you know, I think, I mean, you like The Graduate, I obviously love The Graduate, but that's a movie we would conceivably say that about, you know. And I see that argument, that somebody could say that about Seinfeld. I do not agree and think that person's a fool. And I think the Soup Nazi is the episode that really drove that thought home for me, was that I think it's the most, we talked about it, it's probably the most famous individual episode of the series. And it's one of the more quoted episodes as well, just because it's so fun to quote and all that. And I actually looked in the episode list to see like when it was coming. I was kind of surprised it was in season 7. I was surprised it was so late in the game. But, you know, I knew so much about that episode going into it. And especially with comedy, I'm not the type of person to, when I know the punchline, to still laugh at it. But that episode just killed me. I thought it was just so funny. And for the obvious reasons, but also all of the things that we just can't, totally, that we can't capture in culture's remembrance of it. Obviously the No Soup for You thing is much easier to just sort of bring back every once in a while than it is to talk about Elaine sabotaging a business by publishing all of its recipes, you know. Yeah. And that stuff's still really funny. And even aside from the more culturally important moments, like, it's that the show was always crushing it, even in when it didn't, when it wasn't the things that stood out, you know, like Festivus is something we reference all the time. And it's like you said, the strike plotline is still really funny, you know, even though that's not something that gets talked about when that episode would be brought up, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's just that, like, the show was more than just its catchphrases, you know?
Right.
When you actually go back and watch the catchphrase episode, there's a lot more to it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think Soup Nazi is a good example of that, where there is so much going on that can't be quoted immediately, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And I pointed out his the cashier, how funny I thought she was. And she's on screen for approximately half a second, you know?
Yeah.
And that's something that, like, you just cannot capture when quoting the show.
Yeah. So Seinfeld has made a bunch of money since it went off air.
A bunch. You sound like Jenny Slate as Liz.
Good. That's what I'm always going for.
That explains so much.
It's based off his last name. but, like, I saw in June 2010, they'd said it was at $2.7 billion of what kind of revenue it's generated as a show altogether. And it's only gone up since then. But Netflix turned down a pretty big deal.
Yeah.
of getting Seinfeld shows. And then they said, like, it kind of came out that if they were going to get it, they'd probably just kind of get like a greatest hits package instead of paying for the 160 whatever episodes. And they said it's just not a Netflix kind of, the plot doesn't move forward as much. When an episode ends, with very few exceptions, you don't really wonder about what's going to happen next episode. Maybe, you know, the invitations in the foundation is one of the few examples, and I guess part one of the finale. Mm-hmm. But even though there are some plots that, you know, exist throughout more than one episode, an arc that exists through more than one episode.
Yeah, and the Keith Hernandez episode is another one.
That's true, and a very funny one that we didn't talk about.
Great episode.
but they said the plot doesn't move forward as much. Everything about it's kind of been copied so much that we can get another show for cheaper that's still going to, achieve the same thing, and that people aren't going to watch 10 episodes of Seinfeld in a row, even though, you know, on paper, they would say that they do like Seinfeld. Mm-hmm. Does that surprise you at all?
No. And that's the worst part about it. People are the worst.
Okay. You want to just end on people are the worst?
No. Now I'm upset. It's just because, I mean, when I was watching the show, I like was trying to watch it slowly just because I knew it was Seinfeld, and I knew I was going to love it, and I knew that I wasn't getting any more of it when I finished. But, like, as I was getting into, you know, I think by season five, I just sort of started getting on a roll. And, I mean, plot doesn't matter if, like, I just watched 22 minutes of hilarity, and there's another 22 minutes of hilarity waiting for me. Why wouldn't I be excited to watch it immediately? Just because I don't care about the plot. It's just, like, it's quality television that's good to watch, and fuck Netflix. Like, it just seems insane to me. Like, I mean, if they're viewing it as people just wanting to watch it, don't you think a lot of people would, while they're working, just put on Seinfeld in the background and watch 20 episodes in a day over the course of their business day, and just to have it there because it's something that they recognize so well, or, you know, that they recognize either from culture or from having seen it so many times in reruns. I don't know. I think Netflix's argument equal parts makes sense is stupid and doesn't make sense. So I don't know.
Mr. Netflix is spinning in his grave right now.
Yeah. It's just, I don't know. It's just so, I assume Seinfeld doesn't come cheap and Netflix is a business, so they should see it as a business. But I don't know if it was, it would have to be a lot cheaper to justify that, you know?
So in short, Netflix is the worst.
Kind of.
Along with people ever.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
I had one question. This is, I mean, like, yeah. I thought that was a really great ending, but I'm going to ruin it. I guess I'm the part two to the finale.
You're part two to the finale.
Maybe you'll bring it home with a really good, so what's the deal with the yard bit?
Okay. Please usurp my poignancy immediately. Go
ahead. Your poignancy and my fury. So let's say Seinfeld gets to a season 13, right? Mm-hmm. How do they address 9/11?
Oof. Wow.
Yeah.
Oh man, and they're so New York too.
Yeah. They would have to. They would have to address it. There's no way they could make it work around it.
They would hope that their season started after. Mm-hmm. I think they would be kind of, sounds like just too fanboy-y, but I feel like they would be kind of on the cutting edge of let's get back to laughing stuff.
Yeah.
Just everything else about the show does kind of point to that answer. Mm-hmm. But it is so New York that you'd think they'd want to be. No, but, and I know this is different, one person's death to, you know, 3,000 people's death and, you know, everything that came along. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think making an episode about a woman dying and making jokes about it and then dedicate it to one of your good friends and coworkers who just died, I think it points to a level of, I don't want to say light, you know, not that it would make light of it, not that it would not give it the weight that it needs. But I think everything about Seinfeld does that and kind of take something so dark and heavy. I think that there would be a good chunk, like let's say 2 minutes, which doesn't sound like a long time. Yeah. But when you're talking about a 22-minute episode, it's about 10% of your programming. I think there would be a very serious downbeat. I think there would be a downbeat like you've never seen in Seinfeld, but I think they would get out of it and go back to laughter by the end of it. And I think I don't know exactly how to achieve that, but I think that there would be that would be the first thing to actually have some gravity, you know, other than a couple seconds about George and Jerry's Jerry and Elaine's possible breakup forever in season one. I think we'd see that times 10, but we'd still come out on the upswing.
Okay.
Yeah. What did you think?
It's just such a baffling question. I mean,
it's so weird.
Yeah. And specifically with Seinfeld, you know, like it's just
because more than any other show I could think of.
Exactly. Because it's a show built around laughing at everything. And this is the one thing that nobody could laugh at for a while, you know, like for a long while, you know.
And so New York.
Yeah, exactly. Like it's just sort of, I mean, it would be the most difficult thing that Seinfeld would ever have to deal with, you know, as a show. I don't mean like as a person, you know, although, you know, but yeah, I don't know. I have no answer, I think. But I was just curious to know your thoughts. And now okay. I do. So, yeah, I don't know. Like, I think Seinfeld is a very good show. And every once in a while. Yeah, exactly. Every once in a while, something like really, truly great comes along. And so frequently we as a culture totally ignore it. But that didn't happen with Seinfeld. And that makes me really happy. Like the fact that something this level of quality was as big of a hit as it was, is so still culturally pervasive as it was. Like, I think, you know, something we mentioned Pulp Fiction. Pulp Fiction was a cultural sensation and also like really, really, really great. Inception is another good example from 5 years ago where it was like the best piece of culture that existed at that time. And it was also the piece of culture that the most people were talking about. And Seinfeld is very much that. And there are so many great things that we as a culture totally ignore from a qualitative perspective. And the fact that Seinfeld wasn't one of those things just makes me so happy. I think one of the few pieces of proof that people are not the worst is that people took to Seinfeld as well as they did. You know, like every once in a while we knock it out of the park as a culture. It's very rare, but sometimes we get it right.
Yeah, and I think I think kind of what you're getting at about it too is that for it to be this very collective, super popular, you know, water cooler, huge finale, kind of everybody's on board, for it to be something that is so against people getting behind something or people being genuine and sincere about their appreciation of something and something that is so conducive to pessimism and spending no time with each other, that is what everyone was able to rally behind, I think is one of the very counterintuitive, remarkable, amazing things about Seinfeld. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of, other than just how good it is the second most remarkable thing about it.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So thank you for somehow making it to the end of our Seinfeld podcast.
You're welcome.
Yeah. You clearly don't have a lot going on in your life because it is very long. But yeah, thank you for listening. We'll be back next week. I think we'll be talking about Sicario. So we'll be shifting gears a little bit. But yeah, so thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.